Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by Look Forward, the podcast from Rathbones on what the future might look like. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So the most headline-grabbing news today is that the lead epidemiologist for Imperial College, one of the leading scientists advising the government during this lockdown, Neil Ferguson, has stepped down. Katie, can you tell us why?
Yes. Neil Ferguson has stepped down from his role as SAGE, as one of the scientists advising the government, because he himself has been found to be breaking social distancing guidance during the time he was giving advice. Ultimately, what's come to be made clear in the Telegraph expose is that Neil Ferguson met with a married lover on several occasions. She visited his home. I think the paper has specific details of the dates, but one was near to after Neil Ferguson had been ill with coronavirus and taken 2 weeks to self-isolate. She visited him after that and another time since then. I think on being confronted with the allegations, Neil Ferguson has issued a lengthy statement in which he said that at the time he thought it was fine because he himself would have immunity because it had the illness, but he did realise, having thought about it again perhaps, that actually the government guidelines need to apply to everyone and this was wrong and therefore he is stepping back. So I think there are a few things there. I think the idea that he thought he could do this because he had immunity is strange, because we have not yet had conclusive scientific evidence to suggest that everyone with coronavirus does have immunity. Clearly, there's a heavy interest in this antibody test, and whether that could lead to something like immunity passports, but it's very far away and it's also seen as quite controversial. And I think if you add to that the fact that I think of all the various figures advising the government, particularly those who are most prolific in the media, Neil Ferguson is seen as the person who is in a way the most pro-lockdown. He has given interviews on the BBC to Unheard, where he has spoken about the fact that we might need to have very severe social distancing for months, if not years, to come. So I think, given what he specifically has said, the fact that he wasn't adhering to it by the letter is a big issue. And also, I think what's happened here is because you had recently, or you know, a few weeks ago, the Scottish Chief Medical Officer Catherine Calderwood resign because she went to her second home, which flouted guidance on where you should be staying on the weekend. She stepped down, so I think it did set a precedent. That said, I think that when it comes to Neil Ferguson's role in all of this, I think even though this is clearly a scandal in of itself and there's reason that he's had to step aside, I think in a year's time, actually what is probably going to be the most interesting is, do the forecasts which the government and other governments have been working off, are they actually accurate? Because I think the bigger criticism of Neil Ferguson up to this point has been, what do his forecasts say? Are they reliable? But clearly, because he has now stepped back, we are going to be lacking that going forward.
James, Neil Ferguson is not a politician, but he still stepped down. I mean, I suppose he's become sort of the face of lockdown, with some places calling him Professor Lockdown. Is this a problem for scientists who sort of step out of the shadows, out of impartiality, potentially?
Well, there's been a bit of rolling of eyeballs in government about Neil Ferguson for quite some time, because sometimes you would think that he is the only scientist advising the government. He is very, very happy to appear on the media in a way various of the other academic scientists advising the government aren't. So I think in some ways this is a kind of classic case of, if you make yourself into a media personality in this way, you open yourself up to this kind of scrutiny.
James, I mean, this obviously comes at a time when lots of people have been locked down and separated from their loved ones. Do you think this would water down the force of the government's message?
I don't think it would, as much as if it was someone in the government itself. I suspect that Neil Ferguson's name recognition among the general public is still relatively low. You know, he's not even as familiar a figure as Patrick Vallance or Chris Whitty. I think there is a problem here, though, which is, this is something, the issue of what you should do with your of what you should do with your lover if you don't live with them was kind of explicitly addressed in the government briefings. You know, the government's deputy chief, Jenny Harris, said, you know, essentially couples should either decide whether their relationship was strong enough to move in with each other or they shouldn't see each other. And so I think there is a problem here. Look, I think on a human level, like, it's just a reminder that telling people to only see the people in their own household is very difficult. And I think that is problematic. And I think that, you know, one of the most toxic things in politics is any kind of sense that there's one rule for the people making the rules or are advising on the rules and one rule for everybody else. And I think that is why his resignation was probably inevitable once this story broke.
Yeah, I think even though he is one of several advisers, and I don't think he is seen as a government representative, he clearly has very strong views, some of which, as James touches on, not everyone in government necessarily agrees with or thinks is pragmatic. I think the idea that he could keep going on and giving interviews as he has done, for example, in the Today programme about the need for indefinite severe social distancing and have that listened to with the same level of sincerity, I think wouldn't have been feasible, because ultimately the person saying that, someone who hasn't managed to adhere to the social distancing guidelines they themselves have fed into for just a couple of months, let alone a year.
And James, the NHS is also racing to develop its contact tracing app, but it transpired this week that the government has rejected the approaches by Apple and Google to help them build this app. What do you make of that?
So this app is absolutely critical to the government's attempt to get out of this crisis, because it is this app that is meant to basically enable the test, track and trace approach that the government thinks is the way that the country is going to get to this new normal. And so the app has to work and it has to be downloaded by a lot of people. Now, Google and Apple are working together on developing that. Lots of governments, the Germans, the Italians, have basically said, right, we'll just take that Google and Apple app. And you can see the logic for that, which is, who do you think are probably more technologically competent, Google and Apple or a national government? And so the government is undoubtedly taking a risk by choosing to develop its own app. Now, its logic is that it needs to develop its own app because only its own app can give it the kind of information on the kind of hotspots of where the virus is flaring up, and also the information on what kind of encounters appear to be spreading the virus. But undoubtedly, by developing it themselves, the government means it is much more on the hook for any technical glitches or problems with the app. Or, for example, one of the big concerns is, what if the app ends up eating everyone's battery life? So people end up deleting the app, not because they have concerns about their privacy, but because they're just fed up with the fact that they need to charge their phone every 45 minutes.
Katie, the app is being rolled out in a test trial on the Isle of Wight starting this week. Do we know anything about how that's going?
Well, we know that it's been rolled out on Isle of Wight this week, and NHS workers are the first to access it. It's going to go to more members of the community as the week goes on. I think we get to get much in terms of anecdotal details. We do have our own reporter on the ground in Freddie Gray, who is on the Isle of Wight right now, and wrote about some of his doubts about it, though we should hasten to add that the local MP, Bob Seeley, was quick to reply with why he thought it was a brilliant idea to trial it on the Isle of Wight. I think one of the things is about Wi-Fi. So Freddie's point was, Wi-Fi in certain parts of the Isle of Wight is not particularly good compared to mainland. But ultimately, this app relies on Bluetooth. It might sound trivial, but I do think James's point, which is, what is this going to do to people's phone batteries, is a really important one. Because anecdotally, I never have Bluetooth on my phone because it just means the battery goes down hugely. I think I have a rubbish battery anyway. And this app that's always running, you can just see it draining your battery. Now, clearly the app is trying to do something very important and lots of people will want to stick with it. But I think if on a day-to-day basis you have something which is causing problems to your phone, if that's what it ends up doing, you are just going to see people uninstall it or not choose to sign it up based on what they're hearing from their friends and family. So I do think that is something to look at. And we obviously find as more goes on, but I do wonder if eventually we are going to end up going for one of the tech giants apps eventually. I mean, perhaps the NHS is going to truly surprise us and be the world leader in apps, but at the moment I think that would be a pleasant surprise.
And here's a shameless plug, because I think the marketing department would kill me if I didn't do this, but The Spectator is offering a free wireless charger. So if you don't have a charger, Katie and James, or if you don't have a subscription to The Spectator, then you can sign up for that this month. And James, in other news as well, the Times front page today says that the government is looking for ways to wean off the population from the economic measures that the Treasury have introduced, starting with the furlough scheme. Can you tell us what's going on here?
The furlough scheme, I think about a quarter of the workforce is now on the furlough scheme, which means the state is paying 80% of their wages. Now, in anything other than the short term, that's clearly not sustainable. But I think the policy dilemma for the Treasury is, how do you ease people back into work? Because what you don't want to do is to basically withdraw the furlough scheme in such a way that you cause the spike in unemployment that the furlough scheme was designed to prevent in the first place. And I think that is the challenge for them. And I think the take-up is huge. And I think the take-up tells you how many people are at danger of losing their jobs. And I think that is the challenge. I think the other issue is, you know, you look at the way in which people are talking about the end of lockdown, this isn't going to be like a lights on moment. You know, Boris Johnson is not going to appear on our TV one night and say, right, everyone, back to how we were before. And so that obviously means that different sectors of the economy are going to come back to work at different rates. One of the anti-fraud provisions in the furlough scheme is that you can't do any work at all once you're furloughed, right? Now, that is a challenge, because if you look at some of the social distancing guidelines that the governments have issued to business, that essentially suggests that what we're going to end up with is, you know, half shifts. So you might have one set of your workers come in one week and then another set of your labour force come in the next week. Under the furlough scheme, no one on that scheme would be allowed to participate in that, but they'd obviously only be working half the hours that they normally worked. So it's about trying to adjust it to the new normal, to use Dominic Raab's phrase. That, I think, is the really thorny challenge that they face.
Katie, what is the timeline on something like this? I suspect businesses are watching eagerly to see when the government is going to start taking away the state aid.
Yes, so ultimately we know the furlough scheme will continue to July. At that point, I think you are going to get changes, and we're still waiting to find out if they are sector by sector, which in a way makes sense given that we expect the lockdown easing to be sector by sector. And there's also one of the ideas being discussed is reducing it from 80% of salaries to 60% of salaries. I think on the sector by sector, I think that you are potentially going to see some form of furlough scheme for specific sectors for more months to come than that. And that's because if you speak to anyone in government, if you look at the provisional plans, there is a general sense that in terms of the hospitality industry, restaurants and particularly pubs are going to be one of the last things to reopen. So you can see an argument that while certain shops are going to be back opening again, you know, a push in terms of retail, there are going to be some groups that you just, if you close down the scheme completely, you are going to have mass redundancies in sectors which by government guidelines are not able to function. So I think that is one of the aims. I think on the 60% or 80% of salary, I think there's a quote in one of the pieces today which is making some people quite aggravated about this idea that there's no incentive for people to work at the moment. But I do think there is a sense amongst Conservative MPs and some ministers that what the scheme has done is it has provided a cushion, which meant that you didn't have immediate redundancies, which you could have. You've given businesses time to try and work out how they want to continue going forward. And it's meant you had fewer people signing up to, for example, universal credit, even if they are going to be made redundant in a few months, because they have stayed on probably a higher salary through this scheme. But going forward, I mean, I've had people make the argument to me, for example, that if you are offering 80% of the salary and that person is also not having to do any travel to go into work, they're potentially making more money sitting at home than they would be going to their normal job. Now, I think lots of people do want to return to work, but it's definitely something I've heard from Conservative MPs, which is the concern that you have removed incentive. And actually, when you look at the fact that people seem to support lockdown still, that is in part because people are effectively being paid to sit at home. Now, I know lots of people would dispute that as a reading, but I think to give a sense of where the Tory party sits, and I don't mean the Treasury on this, but I just mean the general mood, I think there is a sense that the furlough scheme as it currently is can't go on forever because a combination of factors means that it's just not right for easing people back into work.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And I mentioned that charger there. You can go to spectator.co.uk/charger to find out more about it. Join us again tomorrow.
Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by the Rathbones Look Forward podcast. Join the world's leading thinkers, writers, and scientists discussing the future of our ever-changing world. In the latest episode, historian Tom Holland talks to broadcaster Andrea Catherwood on the future of morality. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.